today's guest says that when she was 14, she went through a period when she was excluded by a friendship group at school, and that left her feeling like nobody. In fact, she grew up with Little Miss Critical on her shoulder. Perhaps there were some days when it felt like Little Miss Critical was on both shoulders. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk and to this edition of Transitions Tuesday here on Mind Talk. And I'm very pleased to welcome Helena Grace Donnell, who is author of Learning to Love the Girl in the Mirror. Helena, welcome to Mind Talk.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You know, I have to start with the title, because learning to love the girl in the mirror, for so many people, male, female, 12, 20, 50, is such a challenging experience. So let's just talk about the title for a moment. What does the title mean for you?
I love that question. For me, I never considered giving a different title to the book. It was just, that was it. That was the inspiration behind the book. Because for me, it also, the word learning, it sort of makes you think of a journey. It was a journey for me to learn to love the girl in the mirror. Someone once suggested that I call it Learn to Love the Girl in the Mirror. And I thought, no, that's not what it feels like. It's a journey. It's a process. It's about that self-acceptance and learning to appreciate that beautiful, wonderful, incredible spirit that you see in front of you in the mirror. We put that girl down so much every single day as women and as men, but I think it's even more prevalent for women. And I think that also saying girl, it's like that, it's a soft feeling of nourishing and loving that younger, innocent little girl inside of you as well, who needs that love and appreciation that we've put down for too long. So that's sort of what the title feels like for me.
So was this created for girls, for teens, for women, for moms? Who are you writing to and for?
I absolutely am writing for teen girls. The language that I use is very much geared towards teen girls. But saying that, it's been amazing how older women have been reading this book. I mean, 50s, 60s, even my 92-year-old grandmother. And they've been learning to love the girl in the mirror. And they've been learning a lot from this book. So, yes, it's geared for teen girls because that's a specific genre. And those are the young women of today that I want to help inspire. But that doesn't mean that anyone of any age could read this and learn something, too. And also for moms as well, I think it's, you hit on a topic there. I think it's important for moms to understand as well what their teen girls might be going through, because I think it can be really tough as a mom to know what to say, especially surrounding the issues that your daughter might face possibly with her body. And so this book would also really help them to possibly get into the mindset of what she may be going through, especially in today's society where things are changing a lot with, you know, social media being so prevalent, even more so than when my mother was growing, you know, way more so than when my mother was growing up. So these issues are arising in a different form now. So I definitely think that it's a really great thing for a mother to read this book with her teen daughter as well and talk about some of the things in the book together.
And, you know, I'm also thinking about dads and certainly single dads of girls who haven't got a clue. And this might really help.
Oh, my gosh,
So I think you've written a book for everybody.
Thank you. Yeah, and I don't think I really realized I was doing that at the time because I was very much, when you're writing for teen girls, let's just put it out there, they are one of the most difficult audiences to write for, even down to the design. I was like, I can't put this design in because they might find it too babyish. And if I put this in, it's too mature. And they're very, they're very critical. So I'm very grateful that it all came together in a good way. But it is interesting how it also does gear itself towards anyone, really.
So let's start with your story, which was certainly the impetus and perhaps the guidelines for the creation of this. What was your life like as a teenager? Well, let's start with preteen. What were you like as a preteen?
Sorry, say that again.
What were you like? What was your life like as a preteen?
As a preteen, I was actually really shy. If I look back, I was very shy. I hadn't grown into my confidence yet at all. My parents were very much like trying to push me to get more confident. I think I started, that was the period of time where I started to go into hiding my life a little bit and slowly becoming more insecure. But I was also, I was very active. So I was a competitive swimmer. So that was really like my identity. And then when I was 12, we moved out of the city that I had grown up in London. And swimming no longer became my identity. My life kind of changed very drastically, not necessarily negatively. And then at 13 onwards, I was settling into my new school. And then I started to hit puberty. And then my body started to change. And I very, very much felt, younger Helena very much felt that she had to be perfect in order to be happy. So my teenage self put a lot of pressure on herself, and I not just to look a certain way. I mean, had to be the perfect student, get the perfect grades, be the perfect daughter, perfect friend, perfect sister. And a lot of girls feel like this. That's not unique. Teen girls feel a lot of pressure because there is a lot of pressure put on teen girls to be overachievers and to look a certain way. They're being bombarded with images in the magazines that they see of perfection, and they think that they have to live up to that whilst going through puberty, which is a lot to deal with and can become quite overwhelming. So I certainly became quite overwhelmed. It wasn't all unhappy throughout my teen years, but that was a gradual ebb and flow, and then it sort of went downhill around the age of 14.
What did it mean to be the perfect daughter, the perfect student, the perfect friend? What did that mean?
I did feel a lot of pressure at home to be like a really good student for my parents. Even to be a certain size, I really wanted to please my parents. So for me, that I always was seeking their approval. So that's what that meant for me, is being the perfect daughter for my parents. I also would never want to let my teachers down. I wanted to be, I wanted to do well at school. And I took on quite a heavy load of, extracurricular as well as, focusing on my grades. And whilst also going through the transition of growing up as a teen girl with other girls around me who weren't always very nice, exclusion, as you mentioned earlier, that was really hard. And a lot of girls face this as bullying, and girls can be very mean, and it's a very, very sensitive time for young women. And that can have a very emotional effect on a young woman. So that's what it means to me.
You know, the idea of bullying, I mean, certainly it's more in our awareness today than it was perhaps even 10 years ago. But the notion that bullying can really be a life-altering experience for teens, I don't know if enough people realize how much it can really impact a life. What's your thought about that?
I absolutely believe it can impact a life. And you may not know, as you go into womanhood, why you are feeling the way that you're feeling, or why you feel the need to put yourself down, or why you feel insecure around certain people or in relationships, because maybe you haven't looked at how the teen years have affected you. But I absolutely believe that has a huge, huge knock-on effect on someone's confidence. Even writing this book, just before I published it, was racked with this feeling of insecurity and anxiety. And I realized it was coming from my teenage self, who was still scared of what the girls in school might think of her or say of her. And luckily, I caught it. I talked about it. And I realized what was going on, and I worked through it. But imagine if I hadn't known that. Would I have not published this book because subconsciously I was still scared of what the teen girls at school would have said? I mean, we definitely hold on to the experiences in our lives. And that can become the voice of Little Miss Critical for us. So, yeah, absolutely. If you're still holding on to those teenage years and those difficult times, I would say really look at maybe seeking some help and working through that.
Well, you mentioned Little Miss Critical. When are you aware of her first showing up on your shoulder?
I would say when I was looking in the mirror as a teenage girl. Like, she became pretty much a 24/7 companion next to me. Companion's probably the wrong word to use, but she was there when I woke up in the morning and I was brushing my teeth, and she'd be like, "Girl, you have a humongous spot on your face, you know, look at you." Or when I was getting dressed, "Oh wow, you've put on weight, look at this skirt on you." Or she was there with me when I was at school, and she was comparing me negatively to the other girls that I was in class with. Like, "She's so much prettier than you. She's so much smarter than you. She's so much better than you. Who do you think that you are?" And then she even started coming to me with me at meal times and being like, "You shouldn't eat that. It's got a gazillion calories in." And I call her, I say she, I mean, this is the voice that I was hearing in my head. This is, but I like to give her a character, give her a name, which is Little Miss Critical, because I think it helps everyone to see her voice and how apparent it is within us, to sort of separate and distinguish between the two. She followed me around quite a lot.
Was there any part of you physically, emotionally, personally that she didn't criticize?
That she didn't criticize. I mean, there were things that I knew I was good at. I knew I was a good student. And I absolutely loved acting. So I loved drama class. And that was something that I was very passionate about. But even then, going back to the critical and the bullying, I mean, I was even scared. You know, I'm now an actress, and that was passion. That's what I followed in my life. But I even started to hide my talent in acting because I was scared of what Little Miss Critical or the girls in my class would think of me, because I felt like very insecure about that. So even that, I'm thinking back, that even affected me. But really, Little Miss Critical became very, very obsessed with my body. And that's why I wrote the book, because obviously as a result of that, I developed an eating disorder. And that she became an overwhelming voice for me in a very unhealthy way. And I think that if we can empower all young women to disarm that voice, then we'll all be much stronger as a result of it.
You know, a couple of things come to mind. Certainly, as you have chosen a career path in acting, I mean, if there's any field of endeavor that invites criticism, you could have won 5,000 awards and somebody's going to criticize something. So it's really interesting that that's the path that you have chosen.
Yeah, it's my passion, and I'm very grateful to be the happy and healthy young woman that I am now, because I'm living a very full life, and I'm so glad that I didn't let Little Miss Critical or exclusion at school stop me from living that passion. Yes, it is a very critical industry for sure, but I'm very lucky that I had recovered from my eating disorder before I started properly working in this industry. And, you know, I walk into the audition room, I give my best, and then I have to walk out and let it go and know that whatever decision is made, it's really got nothing to do with me. It's absolutely a very critical industry, but it's also a very fun and fun industry, and I love what I do. So it makes me very happy.
Well, and that's the important thing. Let's talk about eating disorders. You know, for so many people, they think about eating disorders as almost a natural occurrence in a girl's life. And certainly boys have eating disorders.
You think that you think that's becoming the case, that it's becoming so prevalent that it's almost natural now?
I think so. Wow. You know, and, you know, we don't really pay attention to boys who have eating disorders at all. But a lot of times for, you know, the thought is, oh, she's a teenager, she's got an eating disorder, it'll pass.
How sad is that, though?
It's very, it's very sad, and it's very frightening. Because it's so talk about what that experience was like for you. Did anyone know that you had an eating disorder? They typically happen in private. They're typically secrets.
Yeah, it definitely happened in private. I think if anyone had maybe looked out for the red flags enough, they would have known something was up. But I don't think that people, because as you say, you know, I look back and I remember going for lunch at school, and it was normal for one girl, whatever day of the week it was, to decide to skip lunch. And you'd know she was skipping lunch. Or it became the fashion for all of us to just eat salad at lunchtime. We were growing girls with, you know, working hard at school who needed sustenance. And I remember all of us sitting down eating iceberg lettuce with like tuna. We didn't even have the mayonnaise on it because it had calories in it. And, you know, I say to teachers, schools, parents, please look out for those kind of behaviors, because no, not every girl will have an eating disorder, but every diet, every calorie count is the seed of one. And girls are very affected by what their peers are doing. So if one girl starts skipping lunch, you bet there's going to be another girl that starts skipping lunch, because they're all comparing themselves to one another. But going back to, for me, the bulimia developed. So I would go to a couple of days of trying to not eat at all, and that just didn't work for me. And then I would start to emotionally comfort eat and binge eat. In secret, like try to eat as much as I possibly could to try and get some kind of feeling of satisfaction of being full. But that never came, because it was an emotional need, really, that I wasn't filling. And then I would feel extreme guilt over the binge eating, and I would throw it up. But then it got so bad that I couldn't finish a meal without, because that feeling of being full was like a trigger for me, and I would have to go upstairs. I would literally excuse myself from the dining room table with my family, go upstairs, turn the taps on, throw up, and come back down as if nothing had happened. And it was totally in secret. And so my recovery didn't begin until I really admitted to myself and to my mom what was going on. And, you know, you have to talk about it. And I realized, thankfully, that what I was doing was wrong.
When you say binge eating, that, you know, means different things to different people. What did it mean to you? What did binge eating look like in your life?
I couldn't get enough food inside of me, and it did not matter what kind of food it was, whether it was cold pasta from the fridge. I mean, it was just anything that I could try to feed myself with. But it wasn't, I look back and I say, it's not the act of actually needing the food. It was the fact that I was trying to mask the emotions and the feelings that I had about myself by seeking this need to fill myself with this food. Because binge eating, it was like, oh, it's completely overeating. I didn't need to eat as much as I was eating. It was a binge fest. And that was from a need of trying to comfort myself. But that wasn't going to come until I addressed what was really going on with me emotionally.
Helena, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we are going to continue with this conversation and really learning more about what that whole experience was like for you. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer.
Great.
And you're listening to Mind Talk. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. Helena, when you looked at the girl in the mirror during those days, was she, who did you see?
I saw someone that was overweight, not good enough, not pretty enough, not slim enough, the wrong body shape. I mean, every critical thought that I could have had was there. I mean, I would literally grab the skin on my body and wish I could cut it out, like, to be able to fit into the mold that I was trying to fit into. I mean, that's horrific to look back on, but those are my thoughts and feelings.
Did your parents have any idea?
They didn't have any idea until they read the book and what, you know, I talked to them about how emotionally affected I was by it. I think they may have known. My mom definitely knew I was unhappy with my body. But, and this is something that we want to work with moms on, my mom was so wanting to help me to be happy, but she did it in a way that wasn't the healthiest way for me to achieve that, because I needed someone to just love and accept me and help me to love and accept myself exactly the way that I was. But instead, she would help support me in finding the right diet for me, or helping me, do things that would help me to achieve the body that she thought I wanted in order to be happy. And that wasn't what I actually needed. So that then actually put a whole load of new pressure on me, because I was trying to be, you know, enough for my mom as well and make her happy. And it was just this negative spiral out of control.
So it sounds like a real heartbreaker for both you and your mom.
Yeah, definitely. We've worked through it a lot, and we have an amazing relationship, but those are some really rocky years in our relationship, for sure.
You said,
because as I say, it's hard for a mom to know what to say, especially, you know, my mom was looking at this girl, her daughter, who was unhappy in her body, and she would do anything to make it better, except I didn't meet, you know, no girl in her teenage years should be going on a diet. I needed someone to help me to see the value of just loving and accepting my body and loving the foods that I eat in a healthy way. And luckily, that's a journey that I went on myself. And now I've brought that into my own family, which has been great for all of us. But yes, it was a very difficult, heartbreaking time for us.
You know, that's a daunting task, though, for anybody to, again, at any age, to have the ability to love their body as is. As you've said before, there's so much external pressure on. I mean, every commercial you see is about changing something about you. I mean, how do you actually get to the place where you love you as is?
Well, I say, would you want to spend the rest of your life in a relationship with someone that puts you down and belittles you and bullies you? Because as women, for a lot of us, that is what we are doing to ourselves. And the most important relationship that you will ever have is the one that you have with yourself. And so we need to make that a healthy and positive and happy relationship. And I say, if you wouldn't say it to your best friend, I mean, can you imagine saying the things that you say to yourself to your best friend? Like, you wouldn't be best friends for very much longer. And yet we think it's okay to say it to ourselves. And I mean, I had to hit rock bottom in order to realize that I had to give up all of those negative thinking, all those negative behaviors and thinking that I was doing to myself, and learn to love and accept who I was in the mirror. And I, you know, when I started to do that, my life and my body actually transformed, even though I was no longer trying to achieve, I was no longer dieting, I was no longer doing any of those negative things that I've been punishing my body with. And my body reacted through that love and acceptance in such a positive way.
When you say rock bottom, what did that look like for Helena? Mm-hmm.
Well, obviously, you know, the eating disorder, it was taking over my life. I was no longer feeling as, you know, sociable, outgoing, or confident. When I was in a social surrounding, I was constantly aware of how my clothes were clinging to my body. I could no longer look in the mirror. I would have to squint my eyes. I developed this habit of squinting my eyes when I looked in the mirror in order to make the image blurry because I was scared of what I would see. So just, you know, that weight that I was carrying around emotionally was my rock bottom, and the bulimia became, you know, it was out of control. And I realized I was living on Misery Street, and who wants to live on Misery Street? And I realized that I had to change what I was doing, or I would continue living on Misery Street, which wouldn't be a life at all. I was hiding my light and my gift and my talents from this world. And it was just a very sad time for me.
Did you have girlfriends you talked to about this who were doing the same things or similar things, or did you feel like you were completely alone?
I never admitted that I had an eating disorder to them, but I look back and we sort of talked about it a little bit, and they were going through similar things. Like, I look back and there were times when one of my friends wasn't eating, or there was a girl in school I'm pretty sure had bulimia too. But every single one of us thought that we were alone. And it wasn't until I started writing a book and talking to other girls, and even bumped into a girl that had not been in my class but been in my school, who said that she had been struggling with exactly the same thing, but nobody knew. Like, none of us talked about it, and none of us opened up about what we were going through. And that would be an amazing gift for teachers or schools to give to their girls, is let's start being open and honest about what we're going through. Because I think when we admit that we are going through it, number one, that's the road to recovery, and number two, it just helps us to feel like we're not alone and to be understood. And I think when a young girl can feel understood, and that is why I wrote this book, I want young girls to know that they are not alone, and they have a big sister that's been through what they're going through, and that there is a way out, and there is a new way of thinking and feeling that will turn their world the right way up. But because they're suffering in silence by themselves, they don't know that. So I really am excited about all of us speaking up and speaking out about this, because I think it will really help create positive change.
One of the early exercises in learning to love the girl in the mirror is when you ask the reader to identify her own Miss Critical. Explain that exercise.
And that can be really emotional and really difficult, but that's why I give her the name, because we need to identify her first of all, because many of us don't know that we're living with her. I mean, if you think of the negative thoughts that you have when you're looking in the mirror, are you even aware of the fact that you're having them? So I think that when we identify her, we can distinguish who she is, and we can start acknowledging and seeing the thoughts that we're having come up about ourselves. And I think that it's very healing to go there and to talk about and write down the things that you've been saying about yourself. And then, obviously, the next step would be letting that go and forgiving little Miss Critical, and then telling her to pack up her bags and leave, because you don't need her anymore. She's been there trying to do her job of protecting you, and it's not the healthiest way of her doing that.
So acknowledge that she is, in theory, there as a way to do a service, to protect you, to keep you well, but in fact, that's not the outcome.
Exactly. We have to lovingly but firmly tell her to just pack up her bags and go, because she's, you know, Little Miss Critical can also be the voices of other people in our lives. It can be the girls that are excluding us. Or it could be, you know, for me, sometimes my little Miss Critical is my own mother. So she's like this learnt voice that we've picked up as we've grown up and grown into young women, in order to protect us, because she, you know, she thinks that's her duty. And my little Miss Critical thought that I would only be happy when I was perfect. Obviously, she had that wrong, but I had to tell her that she had that wrong in order to get rid of her. Because if you think about it, like, look at a baby. I wrote about this in the book. I was looking after my friend's baby, and she is full of such joy and such wonder for her body. It is so beautiful to watch. She's there looking in the mirror. She's naked, and she's looking at her belly button and laughing, and she's got the cutest pot belly. There is no negative thought that she is having about her body when she looks in the mirror. That's something that develops as we grow up and we start to see society around us and we start comparing ourselves, and you know, we go through experiences that can be painful, hurtful, and we learn Little Miss Critical's voice.
So is it reasonable for parents to really talk to their children about the various commercials and messages and videos that they see in the media?
Absolutely. Like, let's get real about them. The photoshopped images, let's get real about them. I think it would be great if parents and mothers talked to their children about what's really going on behind the image, because those are retouched, photoshopped. Hours and hours have gone into creating the image that you see before you. And that's the world that we're just living in. I would love for that to change. I would love to see more diversity in the media and in magazines and advertising. But where we're at right now is that we're seeing these images. And that we can't necessarily change yet. I hope it will change. But what we can do is see what's going on behind that image that we're looking at and distinguish between that and who we really are. Because as women, we now feel, I don't know about you, but I talked to a lot of women about this, that there's something wrong with our dimples and our scars and our stretch marks and our cellulite, because we're looking at images of perfection where the model has been completely airbrushed. So we think that there's something wrong with us because we aren't airbrushed, which is crazy, because we are real human beings. And models will tell you themselves, you know, I live in Los Angeles and surrounded by them. They will tell you themselves that they do not even look like the image that you see.
Right.
They are real human beings too. And you know, this is their job. This is what they are paid for. They spend hours in the gym. They are focused completely on their bodies. They have dietitians, and this is all before they even go in front of the camera, because when they go in front of the camera, there's magic special lighting, and they've had hours and hours of hair and makeup. I mean, literally like 2 hours, 3 hours of hair and makeup. And then that image goes into a studio, and that the best image from hundreds is chosen, and that image is then moved around and added special coloring. And I sat in an editing studio for an image that was going to go into a magazine, and they lengthened the feet of the model in order to make her legs look longer. They shrunk her waist. They made her arms look more toned. They lengthened her neck. They raised her cheekbones. They actually added extra hair to her, so it looked like it was more poofed up. I mean, it's crazy. We have no, like, and yet we're seeing these images and we literally think that that's normal. And so it's redefining our sense of normal. And so we're comparing ourselves to that. But if we can see that image, which I do now, I see that image and I know what's going on behind it. And I know that that image is trying to sell me something, but it doesn't make me any less of who I am, because I am a real unretouched human being. So if we can just separate ourselves between the two, I think we'll be a much healthier society as women.
So it sounds like, by and large, if you see something in print, chances are it's not the original look.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Unless they've said that it's been unretouched, which is probably an advertising tool in itself. But you bet, absolutely. I mean, if they've not retouched it, they're going to tell you it's unretouched, because the photographer and the product and the advertisers want you to see the best image, and they're going to make sure it's the best image.
So they're going to give you the unretouched image and then show you how you could really look if you use X, Y, or Z.
Well, some companies now are trying to make their brand about unretouching, which is great. But that doesn't mean that the model still hasn't had hair and makeup and all of that.
Right.
You know, but yeah, I think that's a great, we're moving towards that, which is wonderful. But I mean, look, this is a great example of how it's programming us. I was sitting with a 10-year-old girl the other day, and she was flipping through a woman's health magazine, and she flipped to a page and she instantly went, ew. And I was like, what? And she saw an image that was unretouched of a beautifully fuller figured woman sitting down in yoga pants, and you could see the rolls in her stomach. She was a wonderful, you know, she's a yogi, and it was a beautiful image. But this girl was so, a 10-year-old, was so programmed to see a certain kind of image in a magazine that when she flipped to this page, her first reaction was, ew, that's disgusting. I mean, can you imagine a 10-year-old thinking that? And I said to her, no, every single body is beautiful. That is a real, you know, real image as a real human being. And I hope that somehow went through into her brain, but that's how programmed young girls, it's getting younger and younger now. They're just so used to seeing this image of perfection.
Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. You know, as we're seeing children who are 4, 5, 6, 7, whatever, and they're in makeup and hair, and it's just extraordinary. You make the
6-year olds now want to diet. I mean, how crazy is that? 6-year olds think about dieting.
Well, it's jaw-dropping. I mean, there's really nothing to say, except that that's horrifying. And for the parents listening, hopefully your book and your conversation, our conversation, is giving them a more humane view of how to think about their little ones who are wanting to do all kinds of things based on the theory that their body as is just not good enough. You make the point in Learning to Love the Girl in the Mirror that it's really important to love yourself and to change your negative self-talk. And of course, negative self-talk is, you know, it's almost easier to come by than it is to dispense with. Why do you think that is?
I think it's a learnt behavior. It's been interesting as I've been on my book tour, I've been talking to a lot of presenters about this, and even what's come up with the female presenters is they've asked, is it arrogant for me to love the girl in the mirror? And that was really interesting for me to hear, because I thought, well, number one, absolutely not. But isn't that interesting that as women, we fear being seen as arrogant by loving and accepting who we are? When I actually believe the opposite is true, because I think that when, and certainly for me, when you're obsessed with your body negatively, and dieting and controlling it and thinking negative thoughts about yourself, are you capable of looking around you and being your best self and most loving self for the people around you? I certainly wasn't. And yet when I learned to love and accept myself, I'm a more forgiving, loving, more present person with the people that are around me. So, you know, I don't think that it's arrogant at all to love and accept yourself. I think that it's a gift of confidence that we should all have. Because I think that it gives us the ability to shine our lights in this world without having to worry 24/7 about the way that we look. Isn't that more arrogant and self-obsessive?
Interesting.
Why as society, as women, do we have to think that in order to accept ourselves, that's arrogant? I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree with you completely. You cannot give to others if you don't have the ability to give to yourself. Helena, we're going to take a break.
Absolutely.
And when we come back, I'd like to pick up with the read, look, feel exercise that you talk about in your book.
Okay, great.
We'll be right back. Don't go away. heel exercise. What is that about?
Well, we kind of hit on it earlier. It's about acknowledging the voice of Little Miss Critical and forgiving her. And I think that through forgiveness, we can really let go of a lot of the negativity that we've built up inside of us. So first of all, I asked the girls to write down the list of things that Little Miss Critical has been saying to them and the way that she's been putting you down. And then I asked the girl to, if she can, to be sitting looking at herself in the mirror, because this is about reconnecting with that being in front of you, and with yourself, obviously, and your reflection. And sit and look at the mirror and apologize to yourself. It's almost like I say rekindling a friendship that went wrong. You desperately want to ask for forgiveness from your best friend. You know that you did her wrong and that you're ready to make amends. We should all be our own best friends. And it may seem very silly in the beginning. I understand that. But this is about a friendship that's going to last you a lifetime. So look at that girl in the mirror and apologize for all the hurtful, mean, bullying things that you've been saying to her. And that was very emotional for me. This is what I had to do to get to where I am today. And then ask for forgiveness, because a lot of us carry around guilt, and guilt can become stuck in the body. And we don't want to carry around that feeling of guilt. So it's time to release that. And just understand that, you know, she was trying to do her best, and you forgive yourself. You forgive yourself for all of the negative, mean things that you've done to that girl in the mirror. And then I asked for her to flip it around and write a gratitude list. Try and find all the reasons why you're grateful to be the person that you are and in the body that you're in. And I think gratitude, if we can find something to be grateful for every day, it's an amazing tool to just focus our energies on positivity surrounding us and the positivity that we can see in the mirror. And it may be really hard to find something that you're grateful for in the beginning, but start small. Can you be grateful for your fingernails? Or I'm grateful to you for being a great friend. I'm grateful to you for the way that you take care of others, or whatever it is that you can find about yourself to be grateful. I think if we can start focusing on those aspects, it'll be really empowering.
There's an important part of the writing that you've done, which focuses on stress. And I'm wondering,
thank you for bringing that up.
What you would say to parents who have a hard time wrapping their brains around the idea that they're teenagers who don't have to pay the bills, all they have to do, quote
right.
unquote, is go to school. How could they possibly be stressed? What are they stressed about?
Well, how about we look at some studies? Because actually a study was taken, and the second highest group of people that were the most stressed, I think this is a study done in the Daily Mail, that under men who have full-time jobs and have mortgages to pay and bills to pay, the second highest group of stressed people were teen girls. So how do you explain that? There's just so many pressures that girls are facing. Number one, you're going through puberty. Your body is changing. Your hormones are going crazy. There's a lot of pressure at school, obviously, you know, homework, studying, exams, got to get the right grades in order to get into the right university, in order to have the right career, and over-worrying, overthinking everything. Trying to be accepted by your peer groups is extremely stressful. Girls are constantly worried about what other people think of them, which is very disabling and disempowering. But being accepted in school is like really important for teenagers. And you can say one thing wrong and suddenly you are excluded. Or you don't say anything at all and the girls just decide that they no longer want to be friends with you. You're also dealing with relationships, you know, maybe you're starting to think about boys or whatever you're going through with that. It's a lot to process. And then learning to accept your body and the changes that it's going through and maybe pressures that you're dealing with at home. I mean, they are going through a lot of change throughout those teen years and a lot of growth. And that is extremely stressful. Plus now, teen girls are always on their phones, looking at them, looking at social media, trying to portray the perfect image on social media and comparing themselves to what they see on that. So, I mean, I don't know about you, but that's a lot.
Well, I'm getting exhausted just listening to the list.
Exactly. And I'm sure I've left something out.
Well, and the other thing that's very true nowadays, it just wasn't, you know, for many of us as growing up, is the issue of cyberbullying.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you're just never alone. It's not
exactly.
Like you go to school and somebody's bothering at school, but when you leave school, the bothering is over. It just follows you literally 24/7.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You can never get away from it. Yeah. So, and that's something for parents to look out for as well.
What are some of the things that can be done to help teens reduce the stress or that they can do for themselves that don't include, oh, honey, don't worry about it?
Yeah. Well, I talk about my top five stress busters because I think that stress is, you know, stress can also lead to harmful behaviors, such as for me, bulimia, because girls don't know how to process that stress. So it leads to this negative spiral out of control. So if we can nip in the bud and help process and deal with the stress in the first place, then hopefully those negative behaviors won't become apparent. So for me, one of them, and these are things that I use every day now, I talk about exercise. And when I talk about exercise, I don't mean being punishing your body and trying to burn calories. I mean stepping outside and taking time for yourself to love and appreciate your body. For me, I love going to dance class. You could put on some music in your bedroom and dance like a crazy woman and just release all that stress for a moment, whatever it is, or take a hike outside or go take a walk in some fresh air. Do something for you, because when we move our bodies, we shift the energy within our bodies too, and that can be such an amazing release. I also talk about breath, and I think that breathing, because when we get stressed, our breath becomes trapped, or it becomes trapped up in our chest. So if a girl can just lay down for 5 minutes and focus on her breath and taking big, deep belly breaths into her abdomen, it can help shift the stress too. That's a really great tool. And also sleep. I don't know what your thoughts are on this, but are teen girls or teenagers getting enough sleep? Because as you say, it's very hard to switch off. We have our phones with us constantly and they're up at night on the laptops, on their phones, and teenagers need to get a lot more sleep than we do as adults. So and some teenagers now find it very difficult to go to sleep. And when you're not getting enough sleep, your body isn't getting the rest that it needs, and that can help perpetuate the stress. So I talk about creating a bedtime routine for yourself where you put the phone away maybe an hour before you're going to sleep. Maybe you run yourself a bath. I like to light a candle and just take some time. That's a great opportunity for you to do the breathing exercise. Read a book or help your brain and your body to start to slow down and really honor and respect your body enough to get enough high-quality sleep. So those are a few of the stress busters that I talk about. And I also, something that I use in my day-to-day life is, as you say, you know, it's very easy to get carried away with overthinking and the stressful thoughts that we have, like, oh my God, this person has excluded me. And if that this person's excluded me, then this is going to mean this X, Y, and Z. And oh my gosh, I'm going to be excluded from everyone, and I'm going to have no social life, and I'm just going to die alone with cats or whatever it is. Like, we go all the way to the worst case, you know, we let our brains get carried away. And I, when I start to get stressed or anxious about a certain situation, I look at the worst, like genuinely look at what's the worst case scenario in this situation. And it is never as bad as I think that it's going to be. And so sometimes allowing yourself to, in reality, go to the worst case scenario can actually help us pull ourselves back to a more positive reality of knowing that we are going to be okay and everything is going to be fine. So those are a few of the stress buses that I talk about.
Well, and those are great tools. And even with the breathing, you know, sometimes if you can just lie still and breathe, do really deep breathing for 2 minutes, that can have a powerful effect. So if you tell yourself you're so busy, you don't have 5 minutes, which is a problem in and of itself. Try a minute, try 2 minutes. And just in terms of the reading, don't read a school book. Don't read a murder mystery. Read something that's really calming. Maybe it's even poetry.
Or your social media feed.
Oh yeah, don't read. Oh my goodness, please don't read that.
I have been guilty of before I go to sleep, so I know that it's a habit we have to unlearn. But yeah, pick something that you enjoy reading and that you love, that you can help switch your brain off. And also about the breathing. Once you get into the habit of breathing more deeply and centering yourself and becoming more grounded through the breath, if you start to feel yourself becoming anxious or stressed in situations, no one needs to know what you're doing. You can use that breath anywhere. You could even just lightly place your hand on your stomach and just try and take some big, deep belly breaths into it. And you could do that in the car. You can do that at your school locker. You can do that in the bathrooms. Like, it can be anywhere. Just take that time to take some really deep inhales and exhales and refocus the breath.
And you feel it not only emotionally, but you actually can physically feel your body letting go of the stress. It's very, very
absolutely
powerful.
And that then helps you to become more aware of your body as a whole, because I now am so in tune with my body that I know when I'm in a situation that doesn't feel right for me, I can tell by the way that my breath reacts and the way that my body reacts. So that can really be empowering, just to know and be aware of your instincts that are within you and your body. Your body tells you how you're feeling. We just have to be aware enough to listen to it.
So your body gets to be your friend, not your enemy.
Absolutely. If we can all learn that, wow, what an amazing world to live in. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You make a comment in your book that I'd like for you to just say a little bit more about. Listen to your fears, but don't let them drive the car. Can you say a couple more words about that?
Yeah, so there's also someone called Little Miss Fear. And she's, you know, fear is there to actually keep us alive. You know, fear is an instinct that we've, you know, had since, you know, being cavemen, who have to have the fight or flight syndrome to either, you know, do we run from the herd of cattle that is coming towards us? You know, it gives us the adrenaline that we need to protect ourselves. It's fear is there when you know that if you could pick up a hot kettle that you're going to burn yourself. Except fear in the 21st century has become a whole other aspect of, it's very hard to switch off from it. And so I talk about making friends with fear and understanding why fear is there, but not letting it take the driver's seat of your life. Like, you can come along for the ride, but I don't want you to take control of my life. And fear will come up. Fear is going to be there. I mean, even when I was writing this book about learning to love the girl in the mirror, a massive Little Miss Fear came up for me. And I talked about the story in my book, and I had to make friends with her and apologize and realize that, like, oh my gosh, I'm letting Little Miss Fear take control right now. but this is because I'm feeling really these feelings, these emotions, and I'm not processing. So don't let Little Miss Fear become so overwhelming that she starts driving your car, because we don't want her in the driver's seat.
Not at all. We just want you to be aware of and be curious about her.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Curious is a really good way to put it. Absolutely.
You talk a fair amount about something that you call a sneaky food bandit. In the couple of minutes that we have left, can you just give us a thumbnail sketch of this sneaky food bandit?
Yeah, I talk a little bit about it, sugar, actually. And so I dieted so much in a very negative way and tried to control the foods that I was eating. And actually, when I stopped all of that and learned to love and appreciate the food that I eat in a way that can nourish my body and feed it and fuel it, I ended up losing weight and achieving the body that I have now without trying to, in a very healthy, positive way. And so I really became very passionate about food and how it can have such a positive effect on the body. And I don't cut out food groups in my diet, but what I have become very aware of is sugar and processed foods. I try to eat foods that are as natural and organic and whole as I can, that haven't gone through 10 steps of processing in order for me to eat them. And sugar is the sneakiest food bandit. In fact, research was done that when rats were, an experiment done on rats, and when given a choice between cocaine and sugar, the rats chose sugar, because that is highly processed white sugar is extremely addictive, and it is in so many of the foods that we are seeing on the shelves. And so if you could maybe just become aware of sugar, because sugar actually in low-calorie foods, there is more sugar because they've taken out the fat and replaced it with sugar in order for it to taste okay. But sugar converts to fat in the body. So it's actually a catch-22. And I became the only thing I will look at in my foods. I will not count calories. I look at the ingredients and I see how much sugar is in it. And 4 grams of sugar is equivalent to 1 teaspoon of sugar. So when you see something with like 32 grams of sugar in it, one yogurt with 32 grams of sugar in it, that is way more sugar than the body needs. And so if you can picture how many teaspoons of sugar that is, it just helps you to become self-aware of the effect that that might be having on your body. So that's just something to look at. I call it the sneaky food bandit because of that.
And for good reason. Helena Grace Donnell, author of Learning to Love the Girl in the Mirror. Thank you so much for joining us today. And your website is girlunfiltered.com for more information. Helena, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're so welcome. Thank you for having me. If you want to follow, the Instagram is @girl_unfiltered, and that's a great way to keep up with what's going on as well.
Terrific. Thank you. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you on demand at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. You can also download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes Store or the Google Play Store. I'd love to hear from you. The email is pamela@mindtalk.org. That's PAMELA at mindtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's just unacceptable. You take care.